Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, the January edition of our Back to School Club. Kate Chopin's The Awakening is our book for this month, and I hope that many of you had a chance to read it. If not, you will still find the conversation interesting, I'm sure, because of the guests that we have on the air with us. Russ Castronovo, professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison, who's been with us for every single one of our book clubs, and also Emily Toth is joining us, a Kate Chopin biographer and professor of English at Louisiana State University. The novel has claimed, as the preface says to the edition that I have of this book, its rightful place as a classic of American literature. But for the first half century after its publication, The Awakening languished in obscurity, out of print in America for almost 60 years. It was condemned by early reviewers for its immoral or amoral sensibility, and the novel continued to be ignored by all but a few important critics and shapers of the American literary tradition. But in the 1970s came the impact of feminist criticism and its focus on women, and it brought Kate Chopin and her work back into prominence. And so many people have been reading The Awakening since then. We will talk about the book with both of our guests and welcome your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page. We'd like to hear from you at the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Russ Castronovo, hello once again. Hi.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Yeah, great to have you with us. And Emily Toth, Kate Chopin biographer, thank you, Professor Toth, very much for being with us.
Oh, I'm happy to do this.
Yeah. Let's start with you, Professor Toth, and what happened to this book? It's kind of an unusual story, isn't it? The reviews were very harsh when it came out, and then it virtually disappeared for like 50 years before we started reading it again.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that the idea we have is that the reviews were all harsh. Actually, they were not entirely harsh. What happened is the reviews from men were mostly harsh. The ones from women were, yeah, maybe she has something to say.
Mm.
But the literary establishment was consisted of fairly conservative men who didn't like the idea that a woman character in a book could reach out beyond the traditional confines of marriage. So it was really more the men condemning it, but that they controlled publishing, so that was what happened. And yeah, so it was forgotten for 50 years or so, as you said. The rediscovery was quite interesting. There was a man named Per Sejersted, who was a Norwegian scholar. He was a graduate student at Harvard. And one of his professors, who was French, said, "There's a book you might be interested in reading." And Per Sejersted happened to be the son of a women's rights leader in Norway.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, it's one of these match.com sort of things before we had it. And he fell in love with The Awakening and fell in love with Kate Chopin. Of course, she was dead. But does that stop us? No. I mean, book lovers, you know. So he decided to bring her work back into print, not only The Awakening, but he trekked across the Atlantic, I don't know how many times, copying her manuscripts by hand and pencil, because that's what you had to do then, to create her collected works, to put
remarkable
them all together.
Huh. And Professor Castronovo, put this in historical times for us. What would it have been like for a book like this to have come out in 1899? Would it have been considered very racy? Too much for the times?
Indeed, that's the case. And the reviews, the ones that do condemn it for being about, quote, like merely animal instinct. The fact that it alludes quite explicitly at times to women's sexuality is concerning. And what's important for us to think about that it did not create a sensation. So Kate Chopin did not make money off this book.
That's for
and
sure.
And I think by, you know, she makes, and this is just kind of an interesting figures I got on the sales of the book. In the year it comes out, she makes $102. The following year, she makes $40 from the book. And in 1901, she makes a grand total of $3 from the book.
That's a low one figure. Yeah.
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 So you can see that there is a kind of reaction, but I think we could think in today's media universe, this type of sensation would accrue profits and a type of notoriety to a book. But as Professor Toth has quite, correctly shown for us, this type of notoriety worked adversely and kind of suppressed the novel for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why is it so widely read now? Why is it considered a classic and a very important work of American literature? Emily?
Please go ahead, Emily.
Go ahead and then I'll, yeah.
Well, I think, if we think about it in terms of American literature, we have a good history of adulteresses, starting with Hester Prynne in The Scarlet Letter. And this helps us kind of continue that line of thinking about women's expression, women's role in society, women's place within a patriarchal system. But also there are other currents in the novel that make it significant. That is the notion of race and a plantation legacy that are on the fringes of the novel. Regionalism, the South as being a distinct area of local color. And also one other thing that's very important is the burgeoning interest in psychology that starts around the turn of the century. So all these things have combined to give the book a real toehold in our consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Her descriptions, I think, of New Orleans and the shore area were really very interesting, Emily. Don't you think they were beautifully written?
Yes, I think so. But I would add to what Russ said about the appeal of the book. I think that there's a lot, especially when it was rediscovered in the 1970s, there's a lot about what a woman has to sacrifice for motherhood, what it means to be a mother, what it means to be a wife. And when The Awakening was rediscovered in the 1970s, it was rediscovered by women who were in consciousness-raising groups, who were thinking about is it possible to have an independent self and be a mom? Do you sacrifice yourself? And readers who notice The Awakening, read it carefully now, notice that Edna, the central character, is also an artist. She's a painter.
Mm-hmm.
And she's combining being a mom, a wife, a painter, a friend, a lover, which is a challenge for anybody. And women are still struggling with, can we have it all? What do we have to be?
Russ, you were going to say something before that?
No, but I'm happy to continue along the line. I think what's interesting is the way in which, Edna does say at one point, I have got into a habit of expressing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a kind of, she's backing into this kind of formulation of independence, and it almost takes her unawares. And at the same time, she's quite insistent about asserting herself, about trying to discover a self that, as Emily's pointing out, what would a self look like if it's not a mother, if it's not a lover, if it's not a friend, if it's not a helpmeet? Do we have a self that is independent and vital to us apart from society? And can we assert that self and act and achieve the desires, the things that we want? Mm-hmm. Can we get what we want in culture?
How prescribed was the role for women at that time in that place, Emily?
Very much so. One of the things that strikes readers of The Awakening often is that Edna doesn't really get out much.
She's <You're> right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. She goes outside, and she goes outside alone, which was unusual. I think what Russ says about getting an independent self is really important, because a lot of independent self is a chance of listening to your own voice, to your inner voice. And women were not supposed to spend time alone thinking about their inner voice. The Awakening has the word alone at least 14 times in the book, and almost all in positive contexts. But that was a time when women were not supposed to be alone, were not supposed to have their own room, not supposed to have anything independent of the family role. So breaking out from that was quite an achievement, a rebellion. I should also mention there's another character in The Awakening, Madame Ratignolle, who is pregnant. And after she's to the point where her pregnancy shows, she's not allowed to be seen in public.
Mm-hmm.
And this reflects Kate Chopin's experience when she lived in New Orleans, she was pregnant most of the time. She had 6 children in 9 years.
Goodness.
So she could not go outside, could not be seen in public. And it's shocking now to us, I think, that a woman who's pregnant is not supposed to be seen, as if she's got some kind of a disease or something that should not be known.
Mm-hmm. Do you read this in your class studies too, Russ?
Yes, I do. And one of the things that's very interesting, and I noticed it this time, and just to echo something that Emily's talking about, is how often we see Edna walking around the city. And we might just think of that in our 21st century context as something we all do. But for her to be walking around the city unattended, alone, is in itself a certain type of rebellion. It's a certain type of nonconformist action, just walking around the city. So one of the things I like about when I teach this book is it's forwardness for us in a way. That is, the very daily things that we take for granted, or that especially women take for granted, would have been alien and outre practices to follow.
Mm-hmm. And she does things like just not show up on the Tuesday, I think it is, when she's supposed to have everybody visit her. They leave her cards, and she's just not there.
Yeah, right. What a horror.
Right. My goodness.
And I will say that some of my slightly older students are thrilled by that. They love the idea of not showing up. Maybe that's an American fantasy of not showing up. But I think that there's a certain excitement when you're a little bit past student age, at the thought of not doing responsibilities and doing what you want to do instead of what society tells you to do.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in both of you, because you've written about this, Emily, and Russ, I'm interested if you have the same response from your students. Emily writes in the edition that I have of The Awakening, she writes an essay on a new biographical approach, that her students are interested in what really went on in Kate Chopin's marriage, and how did she know all of that in 1899? Do you get the same questions, Russ?
Well, you know, students a lot of times think that people didn't have sex before 1975.
Oh, 1995. Sometimes.
So they're always so, and this is actually one of the great things that Emily does in her biography. She goes through the text of The Awakening. I should let her tell us, but just to say, she shows us the exact moments in the text when readers in 1899 would have inferred, would have known that Edna is having sex outside of marriage. And students are always surprised to learn that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the somewhat amusing things about teaching The Awakening is the farther we get from subtle language to more explicit language, the more our students or readers don't recognize a sex scene when they see it.
Oh.
And there's one scene in The Awakening when Edna is with her lover. And the line says, he did not say goodnight until she had become supple to his tender entreaties. And then there's blank space. And then Edna cried a little when he left. And I have to tell students, there's a sex scene in the white space that they're supposed to imagine. And they think I'm a dirty old lady, of course, but... But that's what was intended, and for 1899, that was pretty hot.
Mm-hmm.
I did have a student who bought a used copy of The Awakening, and someone had actually written a sex scene in there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, rather graphic. You know, he placed his hand on her quivering thigh and things like that. But there are three extramarital sex scenes in The Awakening, but it really takes a kind of dissection to show current readers what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because certainly the writing now is completely different in that regard, isn't it, Russ?
Well, we have 50 Shades of Grey, don't we, Kathleen?
I haven't read it yet, do I?
Neither have I.
Neither
it's on
I,
my
so.
Night table.
Yeah. But word on the street is that it's kind of explicit, so, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Yeah. Yeah, we may skip
but, you know,
that one.
You know, if I could say, but you know, the other thing is, but it's not only, you know, for students, it's not only about sex. They have to evaluate Edna's actions. Do they agree with this woman who seems to sacrifice herself? Or how do they read Edna's final swim into the Gulf? You know, do they think it's something positive? Is it something they condemn? So it's a novel whose ending invites debate and discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought that the whole scene where she learns how to swim, she's been kind of never really learned how to swim in her lifetime, was a beautifully written scene and really said a whole lot about letting herself be somebody else. It was an extraordinary passage, I thought.
Yeah, and I would connect it actually with other things related to her breaking out of the mold. Well, taking the long walks, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But swimming especially puts you in touch with your body in ways that would be rare for a woman at that time, since women were not supposed to be, you know, particularly body conscious. But the water on your skin, and it's described in a very sensual way. I think the passages about the water and swimming are beautiful.
Yes. Would you agree, Russ?
Yes, and the fact that it happens at night is also important. You know, this the ocean or the sea is something she first fears. And then it's about, you know, venturing further and further away from that shore, from that safety that is symbolic of the social world. And then, and it's these kind of delicious, rapturous passages where we see Edna experiencing her body in this liquid element.
Mm-hmm.
And what might also be mentioned to anybody who goes to Grand Isle, where Edna learns to swim, is there's a particular oddity or stillness when it goes from day into night on Grand Isle. And you can't really separate the sea from the sky.
Oh,
Kate Chopin describes that, but it's really astonishing to see. It's as if everything is trembling all at once.
Oh. I'd like to see that. Let's talk about her relationship with children, because I would think that this is a problematic area, and I'm not sure that she accomplished her mission of... I wanted to hear more about her children. I didn't quite understand the aloofness, the, well, they be off on their own. There didn't seem to be much of a connection, and it's interesting that Kate had six children herself, which is a lot. She was spending a lot of time with her children, I would imagine. The work didn't work for me in that regard. I didn't understand this sort of lack of, not maternalism, but this lack of concern about people you have brought in the world.
Well, I think what we tend to think of, motherhood as the mom being responsible for everything, but in Edna and Kate Chopin's day, children were raised by nannies,
mm-hmm.
or mammies in the South, and the biological mom was supposed to be kind of in charge, the head administrator, but she was not supposed to be the one doing the everyday care, such as really worrying a whole lot about health and clothing and so on. Now, Edna, the character in The Awakening, her husband wants her to be more hands-on as a mother, but she is not all that interested in being a hands-on mom. And you know, that reflects the various, many various different ways that women look at motherhood now.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's one of the reasons that people have had problems with the book, maybe men more than women, that not having a clearly defined role or an embrace of motherhood, people would find objectionable?
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's something that we talk about when I teach The Awakening. We talk about Edna as a mom, and we question whether you have to be a hands-on mom to be a good mom, or you just make sure that your children are well taken care of.
Hmm.
And actually, what happens in The Awakening is the two children are mothered by many people.
Mm-hmm.
There's the grandmother, there's the nurse, who's kind of a mammy. And so it's really a matter of, it takes a village. You know, there's more than a hovering mom. There's a whole category of people who are concerned with the children. But I think we tend to expect a hovering mom and think that some other model of motherhood is not right.
Oh, interesting. Russ, what do you think?
Well, there is the model of motherhood that Edna is supposed to follow, right? Madame Ratignolle. And that she's described as this mother woman, right, who seems to be giving her whole being over, not necessarily to her children, but to, we should say better, almost her husband's children. That is, that continuing this kind of patriarchal tradition. And Edna, you know, it seems that she loves her children, but she has problems with the social role that she's supposed to fill as a mother. And she enjoys buying them chocolates. We see that many times. But at the same time, she at one point in the novel, she calls her children antagonist. And that, I think, is something that we just, is very difficult for us to get our heads around. Very difficult for us to sympathize with that feeling of someone who would view their own children as antagonist. And it's not only the sexuality of the novel that's made it difficult for readers over the years, but it's also this unwillingness of Edna to embrace the self-sacrificing role that we see other women in the model, in the novel, so, you know, cheerfully adopting.
Mm. Do you think she's selfish at all? Emily?
Well, you know, selfish is often a term that's applied to women if they try to be individual.
Mm-hmm.
And so if selfish means trying to be an individual self, yeah. If selfish means if you mean something like self-actualization or trying to understand your place in the universe, that's one of the lines in the novel. Then I think it's more interesting and ambivalent. I think it's accurate to say that most moms do get angry with their kids or sometimes don't want to be with their kids. And that kind of smothering mothering that Madame Ratignolle does is not characteristic of women's feelings, really. It's the kind of mom that makes everybody feel guilty. I remember Irma Bombeck, the humorist, used to talk about the perfect mom who washed her garden hose every day. And you know, you don't wash your garden hose every day if you're a regular human being.
Right. Yeah. You forget to bring it in the winter is what's happening in our house.
Of course, yeah.
Oh, the garden hose. Oh, my.
No,
let's talk about her husband for a moment, Russ, Leon's. He's how would you describe him? Is there any kind of tenderness about this guy, or is he off smoking his cigars and wheeling and dealing and pretty much removed from the scene?
Oh, he's quite tender in the way that one is tender for one's possessions.
Ah.
So he wants to, you know, early on we see him smoking a cigar, distance in the way that you have said, Kathleen. But he's also careful to tell Edna, don't stay too long in the sun. Right. And not that so much that he's worried about her health or as if there was some early fear of skin cancer. No, he wants to protect the fair complexion of an object that he sees as his.
Hmm.
And so I think that's the same way he views the children as extensions of himself, as extensions of the property he owns. And so, yeah, he's tender in the same way that one is tender for one's objects that one prizes, which is to say he's not tender at all.
He does send a lot of nice gifts home, though, right, Emily?
Yeah, but Russ was describing him being tender toward his possessions, I was imagining a guy who goes out to look at his Mercedes.
Yes.
One of the first lines in the novel is about, exactly as Russ described, worrying about Edna's skin in the sun, looking at her. The line says something like looking at her as a possession that might have suffered damage.
Hmm.
So this is what I would call love. I don't know. It is possessive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he does. There is this scene where he does this more than once. This description of his admiring all the things that he's purchased for the home. Right. Walks around and looks at the drapes and the furniture and gets a kick out of it.
And refers to them as his purchases too, not theirs.
Right.
Yeah. His home. His this. His cigars. Yeah, so he's very tender toward his possessions, but not really toward Edna.
Mm-hmm.
And Edna's important important to his financial standing in New Orleans, right? Because the thing that concerns him so much about her canceling her Tuesday receiving day is that how is this going to look in terms of his social slash business life? Is it going to compromise his ability to wheel and deal? So he needs Edna as a certain type of embellishment for his business career, but nothing more than sort of an artifact that he would carry around, like those drapes that you're talking about. So again, if he's not willing to let her be or even recognize her or see her as an independent self.
We welcome phone calls for our guests if you'd like to join our conversation, and I hope some of you will. It's our January book club, and the book this hour is The Awakening by Kate Chopin, written in 1899, and really rediscovered. That story was fascinating that Emily told of how it was rediscovered back in the 1970s. It's considered now an important work of American literature for a whole variety of reasons. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages about what you thought of the book on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Our guests are Emily Toth, who is Kate Chopin biographer and a professor of English at Louisiana State University. Russ Castronovo is professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison and has guided us through all of the books that we've read these past, how many months? Quite a few months for our book club. Two phone calls from you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We just want to remind you that our book club will continue next month with The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, a classic novel that changed the way that we looked at work and food. I remember reading that when I was, I think, a junior in high school, and that did it for meat for at least some period of time. It's a very compelling book, and Russ will guide us through that conversation and review on February 27th. The Awakening this hour by Kate Chopin. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Kay in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I hope your guests can find the spot. I read the book so long ago, but the moment in the book that I will never forget, because I think it's the heart of what Chopin is saying, is near the end of the book, her lover returns, and she's overjoyed and looking forward to see him, and she can't see him because she's helping her friend in childbirth. But when they do finally get together, he says, well, he's leaving again, and she wants to know why. Well, he said he had hoped that if he came home, he could ask her husband to give her to him, but that he can't bring himself to do that. And she says, If you think that it's between you men, is in essence what she says, you know, that this is her decision to make, and that she would laugh at them both. And I just think I compare that to the bridges at Madison County, where the woman says to the man, oh, you decide, I can't make up my mind.
Emily, why don't you start?
I think that the scene the caller is referring to is very significant for showing Edna's sense of herself. She does say, I would laugh at you both. I give myself where I choose," she says, and neither the husband or the lover, who's actually one of two lovers, neither one recognizes that she has a will, that she has a mind of her own. So that's a really startling kind of it's a startling kind of scene, in that they think that they can just kind of park the woman one place, park the woman another place, but Edna says, when she says, "I give myself where I choose," that was probably one of the things that guaranteed the book would be condemned, because women weren't supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm. Russ.
And it's also important to note that she prefaces that line, "I give myself where I choose," by saying, "I am no longer one of Mr. Pontellier's possessions to dispose of or not."
Mm-hmm.
And so this is, and then she says, "I give myself where I choose." And when I teach this with my students, they often find that locution, "I give myself where I choose," interesting, because it maybe with a little depth here, we can think about the way that she's saying, I give myself, and it almost implies that she sees herself from the outside, right? That she's not necessarily, that there's a division there. She sees herself as a type of property that she can bestow on others. So she hasn't kind of totally become an independent self there, perhaps. She hasn't totally liberated herself from this notion of people as objects and possessions. She might even be viewing herself still as a type of object or possession that she gives, that she bestows now.
Mm-hmm. When did you read the book, Kay?
Oh, years ago. I had been reading, who's the German author? I can't remember. Anyway, I said to my friend and mentor, the late Dick Falk, I've read all these books by him, including Gertrude, and I have yet to find a fully defined female character. And he said, I'm not sure that author realizes one exists. If you want to read a completely defined female character, read Kate Chopin's The Awakening. I was so taken with it, I read everything that was published at the time. So that was probably in the 70s.
Fascinating.
Late 70s or early 80s.
Russ, what about you? When did you read it?
I read it in college in this giant course on the American novel, and it was really a great experience because on the one hand you have something like Moby Dick, this staggering, monumental work, and then a little bit later in the semester comes along, you know, Kate Chopin's, you know, The Awakening, 150 pages of it, and it's just as resonant in new and exciting ways. So it's great to kind of contextualize it in this long tradition of American literary history, as we're doing today.
And Emily, you not only read it, you are a Kate Chopin biographer. Why?
Well, I actually brought it back into the canon. When I took American Lit, I think I'm probably a generation older than Russ, American literature consisted of books by dead white men.
Hmm.
And the great white whale, Moby Dick, was the largest of them. But we didn't read any books by women or by African Americans. So when I read The Awakening, in grad school, it was an eye-opener for me because it was one of the first books I'd read in American Lit that was did have a female consciousness, and what the caller said is certainly true. It blew me away because it was a woman looking at life through a woman's eyes, and I had not seen that before. When I first started teaching The Awakening, no one had heard of her. One of my professors said, "Well, she's an interesting minor writer," but since then she's become a major writer, and a lot of it has been the promotion by people like me and many others who just thought she had things to say that no one else had said. There's a book by Bernard Koloski, Koloski, called Awakenings, which is about the revival of The Awakening and how it was forgotten and then brought back. And it has essays by people who helped bring it back.
Oh, fascinating. That would be interesting to read. Can we make any comparisons with Madame Bovary, Russ?
Yes, and indeed, you know, that was one of the things that also sort of condemned Kate Chopin, the fact that she was comparable to these, you know, French writers without morals. So at one point, you know, she's called what, the Creole Zola, and that in itself is you know, a charge of immorality. Part of this literary movement called naturalism talked about human characters as being determined by their animal instincts, by their drive, sexual, economic, but the people being driven by things like cupidity and lust, and all that was seen as coming from French developments, including, you know, Madame Bovary.
Hmm. Kay, thank you so much for your call. I'm glad you're listening. Susan in Madison, hi.
Did you say Susan?
I did, yes. Hi, Susan.
Yes, hi. I just happened to reread the book in the last year. I had read it in the mid-90s. I wanted to speak to the issue of motherhood, it particularly exemplified in one scene that I believe I remember. It was several months ago that I reread it. But it's when she goes to visit her two boys at their grandmother's or grandparents' in the countryside, I think it was, and she expresses love for their exposure to the natural world, and it seems that she is realizing that they are getting something that she has to really struggle for at home, and they're exposed to it in this farm setting. And then she has a lot of trouble leaving them, and I think I recall there's a lot of tender hugging and kissing, and she leaves maybe chocolates or toys or something. And then on her way back on, I think, the train, whatever her transportation was, she begins to sob. And I believe she says to herself, I don't know why I'm sobbing. I miss them. I don't really want to stay with them. My identification with that was some recognition on her part that she didn't fit in and that she was confused about her emerging internal feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a book about evolution. I don't evolution of self identity. I particularly thought that scene rolled in a lot of feelings of tenderness, fear, sadness, and particularly confusion about herself.
Well, I think that's a really important comment, Emily.
Yeah, I wanted to praise the caller for pointing that out, because that's one of the intricate and really smart and difficult things that Kate Chopin does in the book, is to bring in a lot of different emotions
mm-hmm.
at once. That could also be why people are sometimes confused or even angry when they read the book, because they want a straight line narrative that says she felt this, she felt that. And Kate Chopin is dealing with a consciousness that's much more diffuse. Guilt, love, fear, tenderness, all those things at once. And the complications of emotions are hard to convey in literature and hard to accept in life. Well, if we're the kind of people like Léonce is in The Awakening, who want just everything to be very clear, defined, precise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Russ.
Well, you know, Susan has done something really important that we should all do with books, and that's she's reread it. And we reread books. It's important to think about when we first read them and when we later read them. So what does it mean to read, you know, a book like The Awakening when we're 18 and then return to it when we're 38 or when we're 55 and to watch those readings evolve, because we have all these life experiences of, you know, parenthood, of having partners, of having, you know, deaths of parents and things like that, that really change how we filter literature through our own consciousness. I mean, just speaking personally for a moment, I can't even imagine if I had any thoughts about this book when I read it when I was an 18-year-old college freshman. And then to think about it now as someone who teaches it to people who are 19 and 20, and then, you know, are going to go off and start or continue their lives that are going to become more complex and be faced with choices and all the sorts of ambivalent feelings that both Susan in her call and Emily on the show are talking about. So it's a remarkable experience to reread books and to think and use them as a way to kind of as measuring sticks for how much more complex or how much more difficult or how much more intricate our own thinking about our own lives and existence have become.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I find in the years I've read The Awakening that I identify with different characters. I used to identify with Edna. I don't anymore, because she's at a stage in her life that I'm not in anymore. But there's a doctor in The Awakening, Dr. Mandalay, who expresses some opinions about life in a larger scope, and I find that I identify more with his point of view now.
Ah. With age comes great wisdom, right?
Yeah. Or with age comes experience, anyway.
That's true.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about her giving herself where she chose. Why did she choose the men she chose? Let's start with Robert. What was it about Robert? He seemed rather dreamy to me. He obviously paid her a great deal of attention, which maybe was not happening before. Why Robert? Why did she choose him?
One reason is that he's there.
It's
a summer
yes.
in Grand Isle, and he's the only guy around.
Right.
So, you know,
right.
That narrows down the possibilities. He's also a kind of a puppy dog guy who doesn't threaten her marriage.
Mm.
She She and Robert look alike. They tell little jokes. They're more like brother and sister than real lovers. And there are some theories that he's actually intended to be a gay character. And you know, I could go into that if you want. But he's not really a sexual character, so he doesn't threaten her marriage or her. Her life,
uh-huh.
the way someone, the other lover, who really is sexual, you know, is a threat.
And do you see him as a gay character?
I think the more I read about the way gays were portrayed in the 1890s, I think probably so, yeah. I mean, the gay 90s. But there are a lot of little hints. For instance, he smokes cigarettes instead of cigars. He goes off to Veracruz, which was known as a gay city. It was a sailor city. He is never seen by the other men as in any way a threat, even though he hangs around with a different woman every summer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is kind of like the gay male friend.
Do you see him that way too, Russ?
You know, I came across this reading in Emily's book, and it's quite convincing. The details that would lead to his sort of being seen as a non-threatening or even effeminate character who can, you know, fill this sort of chummy role. I find that quite convincing, yes.
Yeah, well, and I also should add that the husbands... It's clear the husbands don't see him as a threat in any way.
Right, right.
And Madame Ratignolle says to Robert at one point that Edna is not one of us. She doesn't understand you the way we do.
Hmm.
And I think that's a clue, too.
Mm-hmm.
Ed doesn't recognize that he's gay.
Hmm. But on this theme, if we're talking about same-sex attraction or deep erotic feeling for the same sex, and we're thinking about how Edna gives herself where she chooses, we need to then think about the way that she's giving herself to her female friends,
mm-hmm.
right? Madame Ratignolle or Madame Reiss, the musical talent, right? The pianist who she seems to, you know, be
yes.
infatuated with,
yes.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a sexual relationship there, but there's a deep affection, a deep interest in giving herself to these women as well, and trying to build a certain type of relationship that is deeper, more profound, more lasting, more significant than the one she has with her acquisitive, you know, possession-carrying, Mercedes-driving
mm-hmm.
husband.
mm-hmm. And it has to be with people she feels are worth it, right?
Yeah, and it's startling to do what I've sometimes done is to just read aloud her conversations with her husband or with Robert, and then read aloud her conversations with the women. And with the women, she has very profound conversations about the meaning of life and what kind of person she is. With the men, she just talks about everyday stuff or jokes, or sometimes the conversation isn't even shown. It's just they had a little laugh together. So it's almost as if she's bridging two different universes, and the universe of profound feeling, or talking about emotions, is the universe of conversations with women.
More phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655. It's our January book club. Kate Chopin's The Awakening is the book. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I was wondering if your guests could discuss religion in relationship to both Kate Chopin and to this novel. I join about every book group that will have me, and for one up here, we just finished Anne Patchen's The Patron Saint of Liars, and it's been a long time ago that anybody even asked me to read The Awakening. But in that Anne Patchen's book, a married woman who discovers she's pregnant, leaves her husband, goes to Tennessee or Kentucky, and lives with a group of nuns, and then when her husband appears near the end of the book, tracking her down, she disappears again. Mm-hmm. And in the discussion, which was in a group made up largely of women, I was amazed how many of the women talked about how selfish she was, how very, very selfish she was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Kate Chopin was raised as an Irish Catholic girl, wasn't she?
Well, she was raised as a Catholic. Her mother was French. French. Well, they called her French. She was had a French background. Her father was Irish, but he died when she was five, so it was really her mom. More French background.
But she went to Catholic schools.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. But she went to the Catholic schools that were the more questioning kind, Sacred Heart Academy, which is kind of like the Jesuits. It's the branch of Catholicism that's always asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she would have been one of the nuns on the bus, but her friend might have been. the caller's question about religion is quite worth discussing, because the passages about religion and the awakening are often odd. There's one passage where Edna thinks about the wisdom that's descended upon her, and it's not common that the Holy Ghost would give that much wisdom to a 28-year-old woman.
Hmm.
And then there's another part where she goes... She's not feeling well. Well, she's feeling okay, and she goes into a chapel, Lourdes, which is where you're supposed to get well. She gets sick.
Mm. Mm.
So I think there are little jokes about from the Catholic background too.
Mm-hmm. Rich, thanks very much for the call. Russ, let's direct this one to you to begin with. This is from Rebecca. I picked up a beautiful hardcover copy of this book in a secondhand store with black and white photos of Grand Island and New Orleans and Kate herself. I love the sense of how time moved in this book, sometimes standing still, sometimes propelled forward so smoothly. Could you comment on the character of Edna with Virginia Woolf?
Wow. That brings me back to like my doctoral exams, that question. but you know, I think the way that I would begin to approach this question would be by looking at something like the ocean, which at one point, as Emily has spoken, is this place of stillness, right, where she kind of immerses herself in this unchanging primal matter. At the same time, the ocean is this place of change with these the waves are called these serpentine wavelets that curl around her ankles, that each day seems the dawn of a new Venus, as you know, Chopin describes it, and it's an environment that is subject to a type of radical transformation every day. And I think that's what Edna is caught between. Is she going to stay the same in this eternal way of woman forever, or is she going to be someone who, as a previous caller said, evolves every day, awakens anew every day to a new self, and the possibility that the self that she was yesterday might not be the self that she was is today, or the self that she's going to be tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So it is this kind of very evolving, mutating, transformative landscape of that is the temporal dimension of the novel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Leah in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to put a modern spin on this about motherly love and guilt and attachment. I was talking to a nanny in New York City, and she said, well, I was let go from my last job. And I said, why? And she said, because the father of the little child was upset that when he came home from work, all that the child cared about was going down in the elevator with the nanny, because she didn't really want the nanny to leave.
Hmm.
And he was upset that she wasn't more attached to her own mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was really relevant to what we've been talking about, the different needs of a mother who wants to be independent and work and needs a nanny, and the father who wants, or as in the book, the husband who wants his wife to be an emotional, maternal type.
Yes. Thank you very much, Leah, for the call. We are almost out of time, and I want Russ to plug a little bit to our next book, because he knows this book inside out. So I want to thank you, Emily, so much for being with us, and for all your scholarship on Kate Chopin as well, and resurrecting her, actually. That's a big thing to do in your life. You resurrected her.
Yeah, I did it myself.
Yeah. I know. Thank you. Emily Toth is a Chopin biographer and professor of English at Louisiana State University. And Russ Castronovo is professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison. In 15 seconds, Russ, why should we read or reread, as the case may be, The Jungle?
Well, what I want to hear next month from people is what you already told us, Kathleen. How many people did this book change in their eating habits, their view towards meat? How has this book changed the very things that we put inside our mouths? And I think that, you know, to think that literature could do that, that's something to reckon with. So I think that's what we want to talk about next month. So I hope I get callers from diehard meat eaters, vegans, vegetarians, and I think we'll have a great conversation.
Yes, I'm sure we will. Thank you both so much for being with us. The book club this month was The Awakening by Kate Chopin. And again, next month it is The Jungle, Upton Sinclair's classic novel. We will talk about it on February 27th. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. Thanks for all of your calls. A lot of you read this book. I could tell. That's good. It's a good thing. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.